Scott McCauley, and I'm interviewing Stan Weir at his home in San Pedro. This is our third interview. When we ended our last session, Stan, I had asked you when you had become a politically active socialist.
In 1943, I had met some communists at UCLA before the war and never even really got in a dialogue with them. They didn't seem to be serious people. They were in the midst of turning up the war effort for a second front in Russia, a second front in Europe. And I met, I think I mentioned Oliver Pillsworth, and he was an Orite, and he couldn't talk. He couldn't relate to me.
He was a seaman.
He was a seaman, right. But then I got on the Mormaglark, and we had one, we were missing one AB. We didn't have a full crew. We only had, one watch with only one AB on it. At any rate, I was working with the gang forward, the deck gang. We all worked together in port. And since watches aren't being stood, it was my turn to make coffee. So I went aft at about 9:30, and I put coffee on for us all and went out to the gangway and was just looking around, standing there, waiting for the coffee to perk good. And I could see this sea bag coming down the dock. And all I could see was sort of a pigeon-toed walk underneath it, feet and legs. And I couldn't see the man's face at all. But I saw the sea bag coming, and it was an immense sea bag, and it covered him entirely. I kind of chuckled myself, but I figured that must be the AB, the last AB out of the hiring hall for. And he came up the gangway, and I said, you from the hall, Sailors Union? He said, yeah. I said, you're an AB. He said, I said, good.
What is an AB?
Able-bodied seaman.
Oh,
able-bodied. And that's your AB ticket is one of the most important parts of your seaman's papers at that time. At that time, it was the Department of Commerce issued the papers rather than the Coast Guard, which took over right after the war closed. And I could tell he was Jewish. And his name, he introduced himself to me as Max Shapiro. And I told him, put your gear in there and let's get on deck. And I did it on purpose. I went up and I introduced him to everybody. First and last name, a handshake. I've always found that best. And they had to say hello to him and how, and they got another guy standing there that they like. And they don't want to embarrass anybody. But there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the Sailors Union. There were only a few Jewish sailors. And Morris Weisberger and Maxie Kornblatt and Maxie Weisbach, who was half Hawaiian, half Jewish, they were all leading members of the union. Officials at some level or other. But I wasn't going to take any chances. So this Max Shapiro, he knew what I was doing, and he appreciated it. So when we left for Australia, he and I started having conversations. And they were not, they didn't come on as a hot political at all. We talked about, he asked me what I was reading. I said, I'm reading Henry Miller right now. And God, that didn't impress him. I could tell that he didn't like the fact that I was reading Henry Miller. Wished I was reading something else. So I would say about there was a big deck cargo on the ship. High silhouettes and everything like that. Forward of the house. A midship house. And he and I would go out there in the morning. I was on the 12 to 4, I think. And he and I would go out there when I was off watch. Pretty soon more guys came and more guys came because they found he could answer questions in many fields, including mathematics or geography or physiology or whatever. He's an extremely well-read guy. And he didn't have any airs about it. He had no college degrees or anything like that. He got a real education in the movement in New York, reading, all fields. There were a couple of guys from Pedro on that ship. They were both black gang. And I remember one of them saying to me, "I listen to every word he says." This was a source, they sensed, this was a source of a real education for them. And they brought questions to him which he fielded well. And if he didn't know, he told them, "I don't know." He never BS'd them. He never raised his voice. And he asked questions of them. He was curious. And he knew about music, too, about classical music and poetry and on and on. And he kept a journal on this trip. And the guys were all interested in this journal. He was writing. So we got to northern port. The next large port north of Sydney. We'll look it up later. It may come to me. On a river. And the war was moving up north at this point. Gotten away from southern Australia. Port. Shipping was going in north. And he went ashore by himself. And I didn't know why at the time, but he went and he saw there were two brothers who were the star rank and file organizers of the equivalent of the CIO in Australia. And one of them lived in this port. And he went to see that man. I've known those names, too, of those two brothers. And from them, he got about a dozen copies each of the Fourth International and the New International, the Militant and Labor Action. Those are the publications, the quarterly journal and the weekly papers of the Workers' Party and the Socialist Workers' Party, the two major wings of American Trotskyist movement. Both of them, I guess at that point, the Workers' Party had about 500-600 members, and the SWP probably had 800 or 900 members at that point. And he had never mentioned any party that he belonged to me, but he handed me some of each of these and said to me, "Which do you like the best? Read them, tell me what you like the best, or what you're interested in." I read them, and I liked the New International. But then between the labor action and the militant, I like the militant better. So now he was in trouble. He's got a guy here who's not astute enough to see that I've crossed organizations here.
The militant was the WP.
No, militant was the SWP, Socialist Workers' Party, and the Fourth International was the Socialist Workers' Party. And I like the New International and the militant better than I liked labor action or
I thought the labor action was canned.
Remember that was before the split in 1935. That was the West Coast Trotskyist newspaper.
I see.
After the when the split occurred, Shackman picked out there was no longer a West Coast labor action, and Shackman picked that name particularly, I think, because the WP was getting all the intellectuals and wanted a working class, more of a working class representation, or make it at least look that way, or make an appeal to people who were working class. So as that trip went on, I was more and more becoming involved with Max Shapiro. Talking to him in greater detail, and then about specific party politics. So that by the time we were in port in northern Australia, after we'd been in port about a week, a couple of our guys, the two guys from Pedro here, Lidio Valdez, And Robert John, I can't remember his last name, they went ashore early. They were on a different watch. And they met some women. And the women were CPers. And to impress the women, they say, "We got guys on our, well, man, they're communists too, man. They're all for Trotsky." And the women really were going to just walk away from them. And they said, "No, no, we like Harry Bridges," and they got back in good with the women. But so we all met at the dance that night. It's a big dance. And I was redheaded, and the women refused to call me red. They called me, what's your regular name? What's your given name?" I said, "Stan." So they called me Stan. They wouldn't call me red. They wouldn't make that concession to a Trotskyist. And I was considered already by these guys, because I was so close to Max Shapiro, a Trotskyist, although I was in the talking stages. What I found was that I was learning from Max and the things he had to read. Something about world politics and how world wars can get started, and something about economics and how it fits in with the politics. Things I'd never had access to before, I was getting from him. And then to the sophistication of a New Yorker who knows music and theater and everything. I had access to that through him.
Did you find a connection when you were in grammar school? Your grammar school teacher, one of your grammar school teachers, you remember telling you that that World War One was fought over money and.
This was really probably the only socialist organization I could have ever joined, because it was the only anti-war socialist organization around. There were other. The IWW didn't support World War II. But the Workers' Party uniquely took the position that we reserve the right to oppose this war politically. Our people will be drafted like anybody else into the armed forces, and our people will, in that sense, continue to participate in the life of the nation. But we will be present, and if they radicalize, we'll be there to talk to them. And so we will publicly oppose this war.
Well, did the SWP did not take that?
They didn't quite take that. Remember, their main appeal was to communists. They were still considering themselves the international left opposition. And they felt to take such a stance would be to alienate communists. So you have a couple of instances during the war of the militant carrying photos of a male member in the armed forces who just got decorated for heroism. And that's very strange, a socialist paper. But here was this party that was anti-war and was radical, was pro-labor, and I was extremely active. I had found the Sailors' Union. My God, I felt that that was a way of fighting back without getting fired. I'd never heard of such a thing. And I had the responsibility of carrying on what the 34 men had done, like I explained about the first trip I'd made. I felt responsible to them to continue that message and get that across and to sustain that degree of militance and not give up conditions during the war, working conditions. So here was a political set of ideas that supported all those things. And I took to it very rapidly. And we came back to the States. The first port was San Pedro. And E.R. McKinney, who was the trade union secretary of the Workers' Party, he was a black man. He had worked in the mine workers' union as a staffer. And he was on national tour, speaking. That night we got in, Friday night. And instead of going ashore and having a big time, I was taken to this meeting here in San Pedro of the Workers' Party. Hal Draper and Ann Draper were the leading members of the branch. And I heard Yair McKinney.
Well, but what was that meeting?
I have no idea. Some small hall somewhere. And there was a pretty big SWP in this town, too, at the same time. This was the second largest branch and the most active branch outside of New York. That is, this branch had about 26 people in it. They put out here in San Pedro for almost 4 years running 12,000 copies of Labor Action a week. They kept the women, the female members of the branch, working around the clock. Not only did they work in the shipyards, but they were distributing this paper at all the gates of Cal Ship and the other shipyards. Concentration of WP was on people in wartime industries, figuring that this was going to be a very long war, and it would be workers in industries of this sort that would radicalize. Turned out to be an orientation that meant that the day the war was over and the shipyards shut down, all the work they'd ever done disappeared as the people scattered around the nation again.
Do you think after the war, a lot of the people that were going to these meetings just dropped their radicalism?
No. It's just they dropped the social groupings. They no longer had the availability of the people with whom they associated while they were becoming more radicalized and skilled and more angered by the fact that their employers were making big money on a cost-plus basis and they were being held to pre-war wages.
Do you think women were joining parties like the WP party independent of their husbands? Was there a noticeable membership?
It was the women who held the whole organization together throughout the war. Guys were off either on ships or they were in the Army or Navy, Marine Corps. Whether or not they were in, I certainly can think of some offhand who would have been in with or without their husbands. And were in with or without their husbands at various times. But there were a lot of women who had come in as shadows of their boyfriends or husbands. That is, they were kept in that position. Feminism, women's liberation, had by no means reached the radical movement in the 1940s at all. And the women were second-class citizens in the movement.
Was it the same for black workers on the docks? Were they second-class members of the party?
No. As a matter of fact, every effort was made to enable participation of black workers. But it wasn't really successful. That is probably 70% of the peripheries of the San Francisco and the San Pedro branches were black. But these were guys who would come to the branch meetings because they felt obligated to the guys they worked with, these radicals they worked with, who fought hard and took risks to improve conditions and to save jobs of people who were going to be fired and so on. And they would come out of that obligation, the branch meetings. But that would wear off. We were totally preoccupied with a subject being discussed in a European manner. The biggest single discussion in the 4 years of the war was on the national question in Europe. Whether or not workers and their organizations should participate in the national liberation movements as such, the bourgeois national liberation movements, form their own or whatever. Or what simply finding out what was the circumstance in Europe at that time. And there was no way that a person who was not a reader, a constant reader, and already with the advantages of some intellectualization through formal schooling or from people that he or she knew, could sustain an interest in this set of circumstances. Just too much to expect. But back to E.R. McKinney. Hal Draper came up to me and said, what did you think of E.R. McKinney's talk? And I said, I found it boring. He was a boring speaker to me. And Hal looked at the ceiling kind of, you know, a little embarrassed, because he didn't think a great deal of McKinney either. And Ann jumped in and grabbed me and pulled me away and said, Stan, he feels a little bit like you do, but he can't say that right now. And so I had my first meeting with the Drapers. And then we got on the ship. The ship left within 2 or 3 days for San Francisco, where we all piled off in a suitcase parade and had 30 days ashore waiting for another ship. But I moved in with Max Shapiro and his wife, Marjorie. She was a machinist, really an artist, but she had become a machinist. In Lodge 68, the IAM, the hook, the lodge led by Hook and Dillon, who led the revolt against the International Union and conducted a strike in 1945, a strike in which there were about a half a dozen communists who supported the strike and refused to go along with the party line of not supporting that strike, and they were expelled from the CP. Jim Kiernan was the leading person of the five or six people. Frank Stout, who eventually became a business agent and a president of Local 10 ILWU, was another one of them. Duncan Keir, a shipmate of mine, later shipmate of mine. I forget the names of the other, but it was a big scandal in the CP. And CP was stronger in San Francisco than any other major city in the country at the time. They had become part of the warp and woof of the radical bohemian element and of the radical... And there's specific party politics of those, the kind of active radical. The active radicals in the ILWU were part of the woodwork of the town itself. The membership of the CP in the Bay Area would not expel Kiernan and these other men. They had to get out William Z. Foster from New York to put together a trial commission. And at that trial, the chairman of the trial commission was Bill Bailey, that expelled these guys from militancy.
Do you remember what that strike was over?
It was, as I recall, two-pronged. That is, there were conditions, one by Lodge 68 that very few lodges in the country had ever heard of, let alone when. And Hook and Dillon were considered by the Stalinists to be Trotskyists. They were anti-communists from the left, not from the right. And they were considered a threat to the party.
Were they FWP or WP?
No. No, but they were influenced by various Trotskyists. And I don't know which ones. I wasn't in on that. Anyway, Marge was in this lodge, 68. Now, the history of 68 is really a fascinating history, because it involves all the fight, the infighting between a local union and and the International Union. There was a lodge 168 of the machinists created to be in the CIO and be a CIO machinist union. And between the government and the employers and the CP, Hook and Dylan lost out on that, and they had to remain within the AFL. In the East Bay, the machinists formed a steelworkers local 1304, which became the first and only really highly skilled tool and die maker machinist local in the CIO. It was unique in the CIO. They had to join the steelworkers. There was no CIO machinists as such. But those two locals, even after 1304 organized, worked together in solidarity with one another. There's a historian who's done his doctoral dissertation on Lodge 68 at Berkeley, sociologist, or I forgot it, sociologist or historian, Richard Boyden, B-O-Y-D-E-N. He is now working for the National Archives Office in San Francisco.
So how long did you live with Max and Marge in San Francisco?
On and off for 2 or 3 years. They had a fairly large, rent-controlled, $19 a month apartment. Every window looked, that Pullman apartment looked out over the Golden Gate. It was magnificent. I had this small room in front at the corner of Filbert and Kearney, right underneath Coit Tower. It was great stuff. At any rate, there was a branch of the Workers' Party in East Bay and around Max and Carlo, the cartoonist, Joe Cohen, cartoonist for Labor Action, who was in San Francisco. There was a small contingent in San Francisco. So branch meetings would be the 8 people from San Francisco and the 9 people from the East Bay, like that. You know, 15, 16 people at a branch meeting held on one side of the bay one week and another side of the bay the following week. Weekly meeting, sometimes 2. The big discussion going on right then and there was, as I mentioned before, on the national question in Europe. And that was going to be the biggest single topic fought out at the 1944 convention of the Workers' Party.
Is that what differentiated, the basic differentiation between you and the SWP and, say, the Olerites? Were you all divided over this national?
No. No. This was something that was being fought out within, were we still on? Mm-hmm. Within the Workers' Party, and the following thing was occurring. Max Shackman and the rest of the leadership in New York of the political committee were beginning to see the destructiveness of the war. That the total war was so damaging to the movement. It was creating thousands and thousands of displaced people, and it was destroying the organization. It was scattering the radicals, thousands of them who had been developed by the Communist Party in Europe. And even the small forces of the Trotskyists were being shunted about and atomized by the war. If not killed, scattered somewhere as a refugee. And so Shackman was really raising the following idea that socialists should become part of the regular bourgeois liberation movements. That there was no basis, in fact, for worker liberation movements from Nazism and German domination. And the group led by Max Shapiro, which was a couple of branches, I think the Louisville branch and the San Francisco branch, and the branches led by C.L.R. James, who was known as J.R. Johnson in the Workers' Party, were both opposed to Shackman's concessions to standard democratic politics, Democratic Party politics, to De Gaullism and the Free French Movement, on and on. It was a difficult discussion And we all boned up for it. And by that time, I had recruited 3 or 4 seamen to the San Francisco branch. And we all went to New York for the convention in 1944. Green as grass, all went to convention. One of the guys I recruited was from Iowa. I had met him on the street in Iowa City when I was passing through to get a ship to New York. And he told me he's about to be drafted. I said, man, you don't have to do that. Become merchant seaman. He said, but it's so dangerous. It's better than taking that discipline. He said, but there's more people killed in merchant marine than the Marine Corps. I said, you want to line up and salute all the time?
Did the merchant seaman attract pacifists? Were there kind of pacifists on
it? I didn't find them, no. I didn't find them. But there's no one's a real pacifist when you're...